You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 160 for March 27th, 2019. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, it's the Spring Jobs Extravaganza. So brush up that CV because it's time to work and the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Bill in California.
Good morning.
And Bill in Maryland.
Good morning.
It's two Bills, one Chris. I think I've seen that video, but we'll talk about that.
Double dose.
So I'm just going to say Bill, and then you guys have to fight it out who gets to speak next, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, sounds good. And we might have Doug joining us because he said he was going to be on the show, but, you know, he's on Scotland time, so he'll come in when he can. And these PhDs, you can't trust them to do anything. Is that right, Bill number one?
I definitely wouldn't trust us.
Nice, nice.
In Berkeley, they have this annoying thing called Berkeley time, which is like essentially institutionalized lateness.
Yes.
And everything they say, it starts 10 minutes later because we're somehow on Berkeley time. But as an African-American, I was kind of like, I don't know if you guys know, this is just a weak version of colored people's time, except for you guys are still even early for that. Like colored people's time, it could just be any time. Like I'll be there at 4 o'clock. What does that mean? 4 a.m. Like four tomorrow? Like what are you talking about? Berkeley time's just fashionably late because they don't know how to stop talking fast enough to walk to the next building.
Well, and anybody who has traveled the world or at least to a couple other countries has noticed that anything outside of like a big city, when you're talking about corporate, blah, 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 everything else is late. That's my experience. Like literally everything else is late. Meetings I have, people are late. I have webinars, people are late. I was in Africa. It's Africa time. You're down on an island. It's island time, right? I mean, it's just, come on. Yeah. So,
Yeah,
it really depends on what you're doing, I guess, and which is a good way to segue into our topic because jobs. You should never be late for jobs.
Yeah, don't be late for work.
No. I'll tell you what. I have two webinars that are they're free right now. Actually, I just took one off because they're going on to a Patreon account, which I'll talk later. But I've got two webinars. One is called Field Tech Basics, and the other one is just called Jobs. It's the Jobs webinar. And Field Tech Basics is all about teaching you the skills to be a field tech, what kind of gear you're going to need to buy, all this stuff. It's designed for people who are really first time in the field, right? I mean, they're young. Maybe they're not young. They're young professionals, and they don't really know what to get, what to buy, what they're going to need to have to sustain a career in the field, or for people who are just re-entering it for a while and after a while and haven't, you know, just not sure what to get and things like that. So that's what Field Tech Basics is. And the jobs webinar is all about getting and finding a job. But I'll tell you what, one of the first basics of Field Tech Basics is show the hell up on time. Because I've got people who either don't show up to the webinar at all, or they show up late. They show up, you know, they log in 10, 15 minutes late, and I'm just standing there either waiting for them if they're the only student, or we're just moving right along because, you know, you showed up late. And they show up late for the jobs one too. I'm like, listen, if they show up late for the jobs webinar, I'm like, your first lesson is don't show up late. It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
Or it shows they really need this information.
Right?
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect candidates for it, I guess. So, all right. So, Bill, you brought this topic to us. Let's kick this off. I know there's a lot of things we can talk about from a job standpoint. What's kind of on your mind right now? What prompted all this?
All right. I think I can't remember when, but in the fall, I was asked by the undergraduate anthropology club to give a talk at UC Berkeley, just on campus, right? Mm-hmm. So I went and talked to him, but rather than talk about my research, which is very fascinating too, but I talk about all the time, and you know, not everybody cares about it. I talked about my story and how I ended up getting to Berkeley, and you know, basically working hard and not knowing about CRM and, you know, finishing my master's and being a janitor for a while and doing whatever job it took and taking jobs all over the place in order to finally, you know, get a permanent job. Right. So telling them that whole story, they were really interested and they, they thought it was great. And one of the things that I talked about is when I was a janitor, I had to be to work at, I think, 3:45 a.m. or something like that. Or maybe I had to be there at 4:00. And then I had to have, you know, I did floors and other stuff. I had to have the whole building, this law library, spick and span, and the lecture halls all cleaned and everything set up by, I think, 9 a.m. or 8 something when the first class started, because then you can't really mop a floor if they're giving a lecture in there. So at that point, I had like 2 or 3 hours that I just had to, you know, maintain. So sometimes I had to go to another building and clean, or do some other thing that I didn't normally do, shovel snow or something like that. But a lot of the time, I had to just be there in case a disaster happened. And in that time, rather than just sitting there, you know, waiting, I went and got all the resume books that I could at the library, mm-hmm. and read them all and started sending out resumes. And there was a whole, you know, story that, if you've, you know, checked out the blog or whatever, but I basically spent a long, long time writing resumes and had a goal each week of how many jobs I was going to apply for. And like I said, I barely even knew CRM existed, but I was in this little, you know, work room with mops and stuff and a floor scrubber and my laptop, writing resume after resume after resume. And I was sending them out and getting no result, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times it was just spamming. I was using my phone to just cold call and ask. And I mean, I'm talking about all of North America. I was looking for any job anywhere in North America, right? Calling Forest Service offices, calling my way to get to the archaeologist, doing all the stuff that, you know, it actually wasn't getting a lot of traction. Well, then after a certain while, I actually built an Excel list to kind of keep track, right? And it really came up when someone was asking, you know, well, how many jobs have you applied for? And they were saying, I applied for 5 or 6 or something like that. And I was kind of like, I applied to that many every 4 days. You know, I've applied to like 60 in the last 2 months, right? And I haven't gotten any results. And you guys applied to 4 or 5 and you haven't gotten any results. Like, we're both doing something wrong. So I started keeping track of it all. And I started realizing that I needed to make unique resumes for each position, and I needed to spend time asking questions like a salesperson to try and figure out what people really want in their new hires and what they're really looking for and stuff. And so I did all this work and then ultimately ended up getting my job. I, mm-hmm. you know, got my first job offer, right? So months and months of being on this, dozens of resumes and cover letters and, you know, calls and all this different stuff, eventually I finally got a job. And I was able to leave, and it took my first job in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
So fast forward, I was doing CRM for a long time. Then the recession hit, and I lost my job. Well, I didn't lose it. I decided not to take the deal that they put on the table, which was pretty horrible at the time. And so I was worried, you know, about finding a job because the job market was so bad. But all I did is just go back into my Dropbox account and find those ancient, you know, resumes in the Excel file of, you know, month after month who I was applying to. And I had, you know, like 125 phone numbers for CRM companies and Forest Service archaeologists and all this other stuff, people that I hadn't talked to in, you know, 8 years or 7 years since I was looking for a job. And I just started going through that whole thing. Then I was able to get myself a job. And then, you know, because I'd written so many resumes, it wasn't hard at all to just change, fix it all up and, you know, start making tailor-made ones for other companies. And so mm-hmm. I was even able to find work in Tucson, which, you know, was where I was living at the time. And it ended up moving through a couple temporary jobs to another, you know, crew chief field director position at another CRM company in town. But it, you know, it took some time, but my back wasn't against the wall, right? Okay. Yeah. So that last 5 minutes of talking is pretty much what I've done, 2 workshops at Cal with the undergrads, explaining those kind of things, because they were telling me that no one really talks about how they got a job. I don't know if that's, you know, because my peers were so excellent, which they are excellent, that they didn't really have to spend tons of time doing all these applications. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I showed them was the book that Joe Watkins and Carol Ellick wrote. It was through Left Coast Press. You can get it on Amazon. It was called The Anthropology Graduate's Guide. And they gave a workshop that I took once at the SAA. I think it was in Austin. Mm-hmm. It's just really great system that explains even more than my, you know, resume writing stuff that I was doing. But they explain about assessing your knowledge and your skills and abilities and building a portfolio. And they even go into, you know, what you should dress and what you should wear for interviews and all this different stuff, interview questions. I mean, all I did is talk about how to go online and break down a job post and write a resume specifically for that. The Anthropology Graduates Guide is a great book that covers even more than that. So that's what I did for the last couple months here at Cal. And also I had them trade emails with each other and build accountability groups. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, the Excel file so that they can keep track of all their progress. Because I was telling them, if you're getting turned down, you know, or getting nothing after four or five resumes, then maybe it's time to look through your thing and see if you're, you know, missing something. But the other thing is to have someone else who's with you, another student who's applying, so that they can kind of help motivate you to keep applying for jobs, even though you get turned down, because you're going to get turned down way more than you'll hear the word yes.
Sure.
But also for the undergrad, the folks that are, you know, sophomores or juniors, to see what the seniors, what worked for them and what didn't work for them, and then to be able to pass that down to the next one. So I'm hoping that they'll start, you know, a couple times a semester, kind of jobs clinics, things among themselves to help share jobs, and they'll have a whole database of cover letters and resumes that they've shared with each other, and they can motivate each other to get jobs so that, you know, they're doing a lot of this work on their own rather than waiting for a professor to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. So with these kids at Berkeley, how many of them knew about CRM as even a profession before they talked to you about this? I'm curious about that, because you, Berkeley, you kind of see as an academic funnel, right? Like people come there to go back sure. into academics. So how many of them even knew about or planning to go into CRM?
I'd say like 1 out of 50.
Even after you talked to them?
Oh, no, not after I talked. After I talked, then a lot of the archaeology folks were kind of like, oh, hey, I guess I see a pathway here. I mean, it's the yeah. same. We were all undergrads, right? You go to college yeah. and the classes, you know, tribes of the Northwest Coast, and you spend all this time learning about these tribes and all this stuff, and no one ever talks to you about jobs. Mm-hmm. There's not really a class that's how to get a job with your anthropology degree. So you spend all this time taking these courses, but application in the real world is not really mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, where should we go for jobs resources from here? Because there are so many things out there, and, you know, you've got resources. I've got some resources. I've got another friend who's putting together a website that's going to have some resources. But, you know, I think one of the bigger problems here is things like the RPA, which I would think would be our hubs of going to find jobs resources, right? I'm pretty sure the RPA doesn't even link to Shovel Bums and ARC Fieldwork, but the RPA or something like that needs to be, or even ACRA, right? The American Cultural Resources Association. These people need to take on the responsibility of being the jobs and training resources, but they haven't. I just went down that rabbit hole for a second. I didn't intend to, but what are your guys' thoughts on that? You think that'll ever happen if we can get people in there that maybe would do that?
I mean, okay, so you're right. There's a multitude of resources, and they're coming from a lot of different directions, right? So a couple of resources, especially when I was looking for academic jobs, the SAA and SHA have jobs boards, but they, you know, if you look at them, they are for professor or postdoc positions, really. And I have a feeling that, you know, that's a reflection of the individuals who are the volunteers of those organizations, right? So there's a lot of professors that are looking for job, you know, they have to do the job search thing, which maybe someday after I get tenure, I can explain how that works. But at any rate, you know, they're putting those jobs on there. But and then the companies also have jobs, but a lot of times the companies don't really have the capacity to go on every single job, right? Because if they had a job post, let's say you needed 5 field techs to come to, you know, the Reno area, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you make a job post and you put it on Shovel Bums or Archaeology Fieldwork, then you've pretty much got, like, you know, most of the people who are in the know. But if you sure. wanted to fully round it out, then you would go to the SAA, the SHA, the this, the that. And then by the time they post all that stuff, you've already found your people that you need.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Shovel Bums and Archaeology Fieldwork are like the hubs. And really, I think that those other organizations should just have kind of redirects constantly back to that.
Yeah.
Or maybe like a social media feed at the bottom of the jobs website page where it just constantly has the update of the newest job that's coming up. You know what I'm saying? Like you mm-hmm. can put a widget on your website that'll do all your social media updates and stuff, they could have one of those that's just constantly archaeology field work and shovel bums. Every time a company puts on there, they just, you scroll to the bottom of the screen and you can see the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the bigger problems of these bigger hubs too is, first off, you're right, they should just link back, but I think I'd like to see a progression. Like if I went to the ACRA website, let's just use them as an example, or even RPA, either way, they're both the same. If I went to one of their websites and I was like, you know, new archaeologist, well, I guess RPA wouldn't really make sense because they only allow people in with graduate degrees. So presumably they know how to get jobs, but that's not always true either. But let's just go to ACRA then. And even to be a member of ACRA, you have to be, you know, a company, right? Like individuals don't join ACRA, which is kind of a weird thing. But let's just say you go there, maybe it's an open page on their site, and it's a progression. It's a, here, look at this, watch this series of videos, or look at this series of papers. Here's some book references for how to find a job, how to keep a job, how to write a resume, how to write a CV. And then at the very end, oh, here's where you can find some jobs. Here's shovel bumps. Here's arc field work. Here's USA jobs. Go nuts, right? And then maybe sponsoring companies that are part of ACRA could also link their jobs pages there too, if they list their jobs on a special company page. Right. So,
and, I mean, I think sort of another potential tangent on that one, though, is that it's a reminder that an organization like ACRA is an advocate for the owners of CRM firms and not necessarily the employees of there. And then, you know, like I said, the rabbit hole could be, we could go down the discussion of why for the last 20 some odd years, there's never been field workers have never been able to organize. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that's missing. There's no sort of like advocate for the actual archaeologist, not the business owner, not the academic, but the actual field archaeologist. There's no organized, whether you want to call it a union, whether you just want to call it a nonprofit group, an advocacy group, or anything. There's no one place that stands in as the advocate for the field scientist. In this case, and that is what's missing. Because those would be the people who could, or whose responsibility would be to service the workers in the field.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and take a break right now. It's a little bit early, but I think that's a good point to move to the next segment on. And take a listen to this promo I'm going to toss in here, because if all worked well, it's about the new Patreon for Team Black. We'll talk about this a little later in the show, but I want you to hear this and not skip it. Check it out, because I think it's going to end up being a pretty great resource for everybody. So we'll be back in a second. Hey, Chris Hopes, you're jumping in here to talk about Team Black, which is now on Patreon. So we still have the normal website, arcsert.black. There's no www. So go check that out for some other resources, links, things like that. But for all of our videos and any other educational material we have coming up, we are now on Patreon. And the reason we did this is Patreon's a baked-in website. I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. We have the ability to take in a little bit of money and go from there. So, take a look at some of the posts that we have. We have report writing basics up there right now, field tech basics. We have celestial thunder, weather shamanism, and ghost dance theology in Native California in the Great Basin. So right now I have a 5 gigabyte per week upload limit. So that's what's restricting me. I've got a Patreon goal where when we hit $100 a month in patrons, then I will increase that upload limit and be able to post more videos for all of you, because the upload limit is related to Vimeo, where our videos are actually hosted. But definitely go check out the Patreon. So there are several levels you can get into. If you just want to support us and like what we're doing, team supporter is just $1 a month. And that is, again, just an acknowledgement that, hey, here's what we're doing and you like what we're doing, and thanks a lot for that. The getting started category is $3 per month. If you're looking for a job in archaeology and don't know where to start, or you have your first job and you don't know what to expect, this is the level where you'll find field tech basics, our jobs video, everything. So join that. $3 a month is super easy. I guarantee you're spending more than that on coffee, beer, bourbon, whatever your drink of choice is. $3 a month is super easy to do and will help jumpstart your career, or reignite your career, or refresh your training on whatever you forgot. The field technician level is $7 per month. Here is where you can level up your skills. We'll have a lot of, I guess, introductory, if not basic skills to learn, from artifact identification type stuff to all kinds of other things. So a lot of stuff that's going to be in there. And at each one of these levels, you get access to the levels below that as well. So keep that in mind. At the crew chief level, this is where you're going to start leveling up. You'll have a little bit more advanced information, some leadership information, stuff like that. And that's where you're going to find all that. You go up to PI, Principal Investigator, for $15. That's where the report writing basics video is sitting right now. And here's where you're going to learn stuff again, a little more about leadership, a little more about management and writing and all those things you need to be a PI. And then Team Black Master, that is the level that's $25 per month. You'll get all the stuff below that. And you'll also get a t-shirt or some other stuff that we're going to be having out there. But there will be some other information related to the Team Black Master level, and you can get that. Now, if you're a current pro subscriber to the Archaeology Podcast Network, check our Slack team, because all these are available at your pro page on the APN as well. So if you want to just do $20 a month as a pro subscriber to the APN, then you get all the APN stuff, but you also get the Team Black videos, and you don't have to go to Patreon to do it. You just do it through a special page that we have created. So we also have some goals. At $100 a month, we'll be able to increase our video output. At $500 per month, this is total Patreon revenue coming in after Patreon takes their cut. At $500 a month, we'll start a mastermind group that'll be free for patrons at the crew chief level and up. So you can join your peers to discuss the matters in archaeology that need action and that you want answers to. And again, this will be monthly, and we'll hopefully feature guest speakers and try to help move everyone forward with that. At $1,000 a month, we'll be able to start focusing on other topics related to archaeology, from geoarchaeology, shallow geophysics, all kinds of things. We'll bring in experts to create videos on that. And then at $3,000 a month, we'll be able to start our certification service, so our level-based certification service. And obviously, we'll have more information to come out on that as it gets closer. And then at $5,000 a month, I'm really getting ambitious here, we'll have a Team Black educational conference, and you'll be able to get a lot of information, leadership training, a whole bunch of other stuff, networking, you know, CV and resume workshops, all kinds of stuff. We'll hopefully have these sponsored, because at $5,000 a month, we should be able to start sponsoring people to have this come in, so it doesn't cost you anything to attend. We'll have a virtual ticket, so if you can't attend, you can at least watch the presentations and gain some information that way. And I hope this is going to be something we can do in perpetuity once we get to that level. So again, check out Team Black on Patreon, patreon.com/Team Black. And please help support us. Even if you can't do the $3 or more, at least try the $1, because every little bit helps and helps us get these videos out. And again, these aren't all hosted by me. These are videos that are put together by me and other experts in the field. And if you think you want to help put something like this together, just let me know, contact me, and we'll get that going. All right, now back to the show. All right, welcome back to episode 160 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and we're talking about jobs. It's late. Technically, as we're recording this, it's late winter, but by the time you're hearing this, it's spring, technically, in calendar. If you're listening to this in real time, or if you're listening to this years from now, welcome back to the show. But I want to talk real briefly now about a brand new podcast. We just recorded what I call episode zero and then episode one on Saturday as we're recording this. So yesterday for me, and hopefully it's out now if you're hearing this in the future, but it's probably going to be out sometime in April. And it's called A Life in Ruins. And the three hosts are Carlton Gover, David Ian Howe, and Connor Johan. And I tell you what, these three guys, they went to school together at the University of Wyoming. They're professionals. I think Carlton's getting his PhD right now, and they're really good together. It was a funny yet entertaining and educational podcast to listen to and produce for that first episode. And they're going to have, I think, a really good time getting into podcasting. So take a look at that. The APN page will likely be up by the time you're hearing this. If not, this is what the address will be either way, arcpodnet.com/ruins. And so go check that out. If anything, the episode zero is probably up there and you can go listen to that, because the way submission works, we have to put that up so we can get it out to all the services. And then we'll plan a release date with their first two episodes. So check that out. And also, you can come talk to me, because all three of them are going to be at the SAAs in April. I know Bill's going to be at the SAAs. Jessica Quinto is going to be at the SAAs from the Archaeology Podcast Network. She does the Heritage Voices podcast, and possibly a few others. I'm not exactly sure who yet, but I'd like to plan some kind of meetup or something like that on one of the nights there, where, you know, we just get the hosts together. And at the very least, it'll be the hosts getting a chance to see each other, because we don't get to see each other that much. But then bringing in some fans of the podcast and listeners as well, and we can sit there and talk. So we haven't really talked about that or planned it, but hopefully that's in the works. Follow the APN ArcPodNet on Twitter. That's probably where we'll release that kind of information, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/ArcPodNet. All right. So let's get back to jobs. We had Doug join us on the podcast for segment two just now as I was talking. So Doug, welcome to the show.
Hey guys. Oh, still working out that daylight saving stuff. I'm pretty sure you guys went into daylight savings already, haven't you?
Well, some of us did.
Oh, well, yeah, everyone who's not in Arizona.
Yeah, I wish Arizona's, that's seriously one of the best things about Arizona.
nice. All right, so let's keep on going. So Bill, now that Doug's here, why don't you lead him in with what you wanted to talk about originally?
Yeah, we discussed in the first part about how I'm using the book, The Anthropology Graduate's Guide, to help students at UC Berkeley figure out how to find jobs and, you know, how to build a portfolio to find employment. But the reason why it's crucial to mention that is because you took the course that was the foundation for that, right? So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the origins of that entire system.
I actually think in a couple of the examples in the book, most of us have been, like, we're anonymized, but I'm pretty sure most everyone who took that course, that was the basis for the book that they wrote. And essentially that course came about, it was a pathway. I can't remember now if it was Avenues to Professionalism or Pathways to Professionalism was the name of the course. It's been about a dozen years since I did it. But the idea behind it was, at university, they will teach you how to handle a trial. They'll teach you how to do GIS. They'll teach you all sorts of different things. But the one thing that I've actually not really seen anywhere else is a course dedicated in how to become an archaeologist. And by that, I mean, like, how do you find jobs? How do you put together a CV? How do you interview? How do you, build networks? How do you apply for funding? It's a how-to in actually getting a job. Mm-hmm. And it was a really great course. I remember when the book was coming out, Carol asked us to do a little bit of publicity and write, like, a piece of paper and take a photo of, you know, what you thought of the class and all that stuff. I wrote, it was the best class I took at my university. And it really was, because you can be the most amazing archaeologist. You can have skills, you know, you could be the most skilled archaeologist, but if you can't get a job, what's the point? There's nothing you can do. So that was the idea behind it, was to teach people how to get a job, how to be a professional. And it was a whole range of stuff. It was 16 weeks, 18 weeks. And, you know, we covered all sorts of things from job hunting, which now looking back is a bit outdated, and that, like, we're looking through, like, magazines and stuff like that for job postings and stuff like that. But we did a bunch of really cool activities where we'd look for a job, and then we'd actually have to write an application for that job. And then as students would form committees and interview each other for that job and give pointers and stuff like that. So that was the course. It was basically everything you needed to know on how to actually become a professional archaeologist, not just the sort of digging GIS theory, processual, all that sort of side of it. It was the practicalities.
Doug, was the course more focused around academic jobs at the time? I mean, a lot of the skills will transfer over, but I'm wondering what their experience in and with CRM was related to that.
So it's Joe who's now going to become the president of SAA, I believe, in like 3 weeks or something.
Yeah.
And Joe has a variety of backgrounds from academia, worked for the I'm going to probably get this wrong. He worked for a government organization, maybe the National Parks, maybe the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
I think it was National Parks. Yeah. I think it was.
So he did that. Carol has a range of experience, doing sort of consultancy in public archaeology. She worked at the time, she worked for the SRI Foundation. But it was about the whole range. So it depended, like I was saying, sort of some of the activities was you had to go out and look for jobs that you wanted in archaeology. And then we based the next couple of classes and activities around those jobs. So some people picked working for the National Park. Some people picked CRM. Some people picked working for a nonprofit doing public archaeology. So it was a whole range, and it was all covered. And the course wasn't so much about, this is the minute detail specific, but it was this is the difference from archaeology and these different aspects. And it wasn't quite focused on academic jobs, really. It was the whole range of what you were interested in. So it just depended on basically what the class was. And so if you read the book, it's more generic archaeology than specific CRM, but it covers everything.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to use that book as the example for the students, because I guess they were interested in hearing about how I did it, but in reality, each person's path towards getting a job in archaeology isn't going to be different. We never follow the same path. So having that book, I mean, that's like a general practitioner's guide. And one of the biggest things that you get is, setting up a portfolio essentially, so that you can keep drawing upon it over time. You're not just stuck with one resume. You've got a whole group of them.
Yeah. And a big part of the course is also having sort of a five-year plan. So it's not just a matter of getting your next job, but it's where you want to go with your career. So, that's pretty tough. Like looking back, it was an interesting course as it was like a 300 or 400 level course. It was like actually 400 and 500. So like a lot of the people in it were master's level students. And I think there was only one or two of us undergrads. If I'm trying to remember, I was actually majority master's PhD students. And so they had a little bit better idea of what they wanted to do with their career, as opposed to me, who was just I don't even think at that point I'd even gone to a field school yet. I think I was doing that summer. But it's one of those things where at the time it didn't click as much for me, but later it really did when I could see what I was doing. Because, when you're an undergraduate planning a five-year, a five-year plan, you really don't know enough about archaeology and haven't had enough experience in professional archaeology to actually know what you want to do and where you want to go. But after a couple of years, that really kicks in, and it's invaluable. I think it puts the mindset into people that you shouldn't be passive in your career. You shouldn't just be thinking, oh, what's the next job? Which is always important. You always should be thinking about that. But it's thinking about, where do I want to go? Do I want to become a project manager, a PI? Do I want to go into academia? Do I want to run my own company? And then it's thinking about those steps that that you need to take to get there. So it's planning that out. So I think it's quite valuable for everyone who's looking at even a wide range of career paths. I mean, archaeology, I don't know, maybe have like 200 different career paths I can think of. You know, you could go into being like a GIS tech or ceramics expert, or, I mean, we could really, I'm sure we could probably spend like 20 minutes on this, just like naming off every position we've ever met someone from. But it was a lot about that, is thinking about their careers. And for students, they may not quite have that background experience yet of, oh, they've gone out and done CRM, or they've gone out and they've taught and done academia or nonprofit or whatever it is. But it's giving you those building blocks, so when you do have that foundation, you can go somewhere instead of just sort of, I don't know, sticking around and going wherever the wind blows.
So you mentioned Joe Watkins, and you know, as being part of this book, obviously. Bill dropped a couple of resources in, which I'll put in the show notes, but then I went and searched Joe Watkins on the APN page because I knew that we had interviewed him. And we interviewed Joe Watkins on the CRM Archaeology Podcast episode 37 when we were talking to the rest of the Time Team America crew. And Jessica Yakinto on the Heritage Voices Podcast episode 6 also interviewed Joe Watkins. So he's no stranger to the Archaeology Podcast Network. So that's pretty great. Maybe we can get an interview with him, Bill, when we go to the SAAs.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm pretty sure Joe's going to be like running around like crazy. Like he'll probably have dozens of meetings to go to. And
as a president now, he's got to, you know, take those media opportunities when he can. I mean, that's what politicians do, right? So I got to say, you also dropped in, Bill, a link for ACE Consultants, which is Joe and Carol Ellick's website on education and things like that. And again, I got to be a little bit critical of this because I appreciate the information that's out there. There's not enough information out there. And the more stuff we have, the better it's Googleable when somebody finds that rather than something about ancient aliens. But man, this is really designed for a very certain crowd. And the website design could be a little better. But, you know, this is for teachers more than likely is what it looks like, not necessarily for archaeologists or professionals.
Well, but that's what the business is. It's like a public archaeology company that teaches that to students, you know, mm-hmm. in local schools and stuff.
Yeah, which is cool. You got to start them young. It's almost like other resources, you know, as somebody who doesn't have kids myself, there's a lot of resources for parents and a lot of resources for children, but it's almost like once you cut them loose, you fend for yourself and you're on your own. You know, like where are all the resources for professionals that just graduated college or are about to graduate college or have been doing this for 10 years and want more information? Yeah. You know, where are those resources? And it's just not enough stuff like that out there, which is what I'm trying to change, and me and a few others.
I was going to ask Doug if he thinks that this would be a valuable course today, because the motivations that the undergrads at Berkeley wanted me to talk to them, the reason why they wanted to talk is because of the lack of, mm-hmm. you know, discussion really in class. And I'm not faulting my other professors. You know, I don't spend all my time in my classes talking about getting a job, but you know, they're really worried about not having the skills to, you know, find a job. And I keep assuring them, I mean, you're going to find a job and you do have skills and, you know, you don't really have to worry about not being employed in the future. But then, you know, like you were saying, that they haven't really spent the time to think about where they want their life to go after college because they spent their entire life getting to Berkeley, right? So then the next step is like a mystery door and it's more difficult to prepare for. There's no test scores for life that you'll get into the life that you want, right? So like there's no way to move on to that. I guess my question is, is this the kind of course that we could make for students that would still be a course that students would want to take in college today?
Yes. I think every university should have one of these courses. I'm quite disappointed. So like I go in local universities near me and I'll go and do like a talk for a class and stuff about career options and stuff like that, mainly because I've done a lot of the stats in the UK about, you know, how many jobs there are and what sort of careers there are. But it's very limited. So a lot of what people get is they'll have some sort of core, semi-course. And what they'll do is they'll bring in one or two people who are professionals, and they'll ask them to talk about, you know, what they do and stuff. And they can be good, but to be honest, like CRM people, Chris, you're going to have to bleep this out. CRM people are assholes. Like most of us, when we go there, we'll be like, oh yeah, I don't know. It's a thing where I've been to enough of these talks with other people where they'll be like, yeah, most of you guys can't get a job in CRM. Most of you guys can't hack it. And I think that is, wow. It is somewhat fair in that some people won't like the job that is CRM. And that's very fair. But a lot of them sort of do this, like, I don't know, gruff, beat up sort of, yeah, you know, there's no jobs, it's a hard life, you travel a lot, there's no job security, blah, blah, blah. And that is somewhat true, except like the person who's usually saying that is someone who's had a permanent position for like 20 years. And, you know, it doesn't really affect them. But I have a real problem. And then like even panels as well, like, you should, okay, so let me split this in two. You should, if you're a listener and you're thinking about a career, you should go and talk to as many people as you can. And you're going to get conflicting advice. And you need to sometimes sort of take that advice with a grain of salt. Some people know what they're talking about, some aren't. But you should be interviewing people and finding out their experiences and what they did and how they went about it. But you should actually have a course where someone's job is to know this stuff, to know how to get a job and stuff. Cause you know, I've sat in or been on a lot of panels of experts, and I enjoy a good panel discussion. But a panel discussion is basically somewhat of a podcast in that you're getting different people's views, and some might be experts and some might give good advice. Some might give bad advice. But you don't – a panel shouldn't just be like people you've drawn out. Panels – or I guess actually a panel should be people you've drawn out. But like a course should be run by someone whose job it is to look up all this information and to be the expert on this. I think you do need courses, and you need people to teach those courses who have gone through and really thought about things, like really gone out and talked and things like that. So like – a good piece of advice is in the UK, there's two things you need to be able to get a shovel bums job. And that is a CSCS card and a driver's license. And a driver's license is so you can drive to the site, especially rural sites where you can't get public transportation. So you absolutely need that. And driver's license, a lot harder to get than in a lot of places in the States, and not as many people have them. And a CSCS card is basically a card you need to be able to get on a construction site. So it's a safety thing. You have to go through a safety test, but you literally can't be on a construction site without that card. So you need to have someone who knows that. And then you tell people, put that at the top of your CV. Sorry, in the UK, a CV is a resume. They're interchangeable terms. It's not the sort of American term where it's CV is your, you know, curriculum vitae, where it's, you know, 20 pages long of everything you've ever done. It's it's actually, the term CV is meant to be American resume. But what you're looking for is people are sending in, you know, 50 CVs/resumes. And really the person on the other end is looking like, can I put this person on site quickly? And I need to get through these 50 resumes/CVs. You might get like 20 second looks. And if you've buried that you have a CSCS card and a driver's license on that second page, they might just bin your application before it even happens. And this is the thing people need to actually like think about and give advice on. And you need to be able to have someone research this and find this out and be the expert on it. I do think you need courses where people have gone through and really research this and talked about, you know, what it is that needs to go into a resume, what it needs to go into a CV. So my personal opinion is that every university should have this, and it should be mandatory, because even there's always the big thing about transferable skills. Even if you don't use this, a lot of the information you get from this is applicable to other jobs and other careers you may take, even if you don't go into archaeology. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys, I've been rambling, okay. But I definitely think it's 100% should be in every university mandatory.
All right.
All right. So, yeah, we have some thoughts on this for sure. Let's do that on the other side of the break, though. We're going to take a break for segment two and come back with segment three in just a minute. Stand by. Hey, everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about WildNote, and I want to give you a quick pro tip on WildNote. So WildNote has a concept called the location field, and you can title this field anything you want based on how you title that within your project info page. So when you set up a new project in WildNote, you can call this location label anything you want. For archaeologists, I call it sites, typically, or just site, actually. And then you can go into your locations, or what's now called sites, and then add in a preloaded list of site numbers. This prevents people from screwing up the site number in the field. You can add in, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of site numbers if you want. It's searchable. So if you say we're going to do DT-001 next, then they can search that, and that's the one that you choose. You can also put your previously recorded sites in there and go from there. Now, if you're living in a state with multiple forms per site form, and that's a lot of states in the West, right now we have California and Nevada on the system with Utah and Arizona coming online soon, including Idaho as well. If these are all joined by the site number concept and by the location field concept, so you can search these in your review screen. You can also go to the export screen and just choose the custom default export. Like for California, it's the complete California DPR export. Choose that and then choose the site number that you want to export, and it will gather all of those forms that have that site number listed in that special field and then put them together in one consolidated PDF. So check that out over at wildnoteapp.com. And if you have any questions, you can always email me, chris@wildnoteapp.com. This has been your pro tip from WildNote. Now back to the show. All right, welcome back to episode 160 of the Sierra Mark podcast. We're talking all about jobs. And Doug, you left off on the last segment, of course, talking about how universities need to have this sort of information. And I think one of the other key points of information, if anybody takes anything away from this podcast, is to list the things in a visible way that are actually being asked for on the job. And if in the UK, it's this card and a driver's license, then put that on your front page. And, you know, talking about the difference between a resume and a CV, I always teach, and I teach this in my jobs webinar over on Team Black, is if you just have a resume, then you need to highlight your experiences on that resume. And a resume in the United States is, of course, one, maybe two pages, but I like to get that down to one. And that's just a highlight of your experience. And those highlights should reflect the job you're trying to apply for. So if you're applying for 10 jobs, you're probably going to have 10 different resumes that are slightly different, because one might be focused on historic resources, so you'll highlight the projects and companies you work for with those. One might be focused on prehistoric resources. One might be about shovel testing as the primary testing method. One might be a full-scale excavation. One might be pedestrian survey. If you've got experiences in those areas, then those are the two or three things you're going to highlight on that one-page resume. If you've got a CV, take a look at my CV online. I've got it all over the place. My front page, because I know, especially as somebody who employs people occasionally, I know that nobody's going to read your CV like a book. We're busy people, you know, like you're not going to sit there and read that whole thing. You're going to glance at it and say, do they meet the requirements? And if anything stands out, great. But if it doesn't, then that's it. So the front page of my CV has my education required, has my field school required, and then has all my certifications, because in Nevada here, you have to have MSHA, Mine Safety and Health Administration training, to work on a mine. I've got my, my RPA when that expires. I've got that up there. And I've got a little graph, actually a little pie chart of my experience as a crew chief and as a PI and as a field technician, because that's required for being permittable in the Nevada BLM. So when somebody glances at the front page of my CV, they know exactly whether or not I'm qualified to do this job. And the same thing with the resume. And that's, I think, a great point that you made, Doug, is to have that front and center so they don't have to go digging for it, because they're simply not going to do that.
Yeah. And that's the things that you really should be going out and talking to everyone in your area.
Yeah.
Or if you're moving states or countries, go and talk to people and find out what those things are. See, if I was going to Nevada, I would ask you, Chris, gee, what sort of certificates do I need to know mm-hmm. and have to be local? And that's something that you need to be able to get. And that's why I think you'd probably need a professional teaching, you know, someone teach a professional course, and if they give that information. Or you also need to be able to think about how to get that information, because, yeah. You know, all universities have career centers, career departments, career hubs, whatever they want to call them. But they end up giving really generic advice. And that's not bad, but in archaeology, there's a lot of very specific things you need. And for different jobs, CRM, it's a lot about permits and certificates and experience. Whereas in getting a job in academia, it's about research and what you've published and where you've published, and you're teaching. Not many people get certificates, but your reviews and all that sort of stuff. So there's a ton of stuff, and it's really needed. And it's unfortunately is a lot of people end up going to like their career counselor at the university or something like that. And these are people that might have like all the humanities or all the, social science or all the physical science, wherever your department is based or something like that. And they don't know much about archaeology, if anything. Like I've the horror stories of them talking, you go to your career counselor and them talking about dinosaurs. And so it's tough stuff, but that's why I'd say you need pretty much, a professional person, and thinking about how you can get that information on your own. And I think that's like the great thing about the course that Joe and Carol taught was it was a bit higher level. So most people wouldn't think about theory when looking at a job or anything like that. They think of it as like a hard skill sort of thing. But it's actually thinking about, how do I get this information? What information do I need to get? And thinking at a much larger and higher level of what you're doing than just a simple, put this on your CV, 12-point font, New Times Roman. Of details like that. I mean, all important stuff, but it is thinking at the higher level. Actually thinking about one of the things they taught was different levels of your career will have different requirements. So when you're starting out, it's a one-page resume / CV, one-page cover letter. And that's pretty much it, because they're going to get maybe 200 applications, 100. If you're seeing something like Shovel Bums or in the UK Badger, they're going to be getting tons of resumes and CVs coming in. And they're going to, if you even just calculate if they spent 1 minute, that's like someone's 2 hours of their day that they don't actually have to look at stuff. So you're looking at 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But as you progress in your career, like let's say you're going for a PI job, and that means, in the States, you probably are most definitely going to have permits in that state, probably all the permits or most of them. And there's only going to be maybe half a dozen people going for a position, maybe a dozen. And that's a very different thing. Don't send in a one-page CV and a one-page cover letter, because by the time you're doing that, you have maybe 5, 10, 15 years worth of experience. Demonstrate that. They're not going to be rushed to look through 60 CVs or resumes or cover letters. They're looking at maybe a dozen. They'll give you a couple of minutes, and you want to stand out. And it's thinking about that. So it's the higher level I guess I could put in air quotes, theory of getting a job, is it's not just hard rules about why you do it. It's thinking about it. So why you put in a one-page resume is because you have to stand out, and they're never going to look at page two.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of psychology behind it too, as Bill White, you've written about before. There's a lot of keywords and different things that you can put in there, because if you don't know much about the company that you're maybe getting hired to, if it's a big engineering firm and they're going through another service, they might not even read your resume. They might just, run it through a scanner and see if it's got all the right things, initially. So there's a lot you need to know about the place you're actually applying for.
Yeah.
And there's other things like also knowing if you really actually want to work there.
Yeah.
I know when most people are starting out, they'll just take any job. But really, if you have, I know this is not always practical, and I'm sure someone's going to hate me in the comments, but the best position to be applying for a job is when you already have a job, because you don't have that pressure, and you can be a little bit more selective And if you can be selective, because this is not against any one employer. Sometimes people just don't fit. I've known archaeologists who would work for one company and they absolutely hated each other and they gave a bad recommendation, and he worked for another one and everyone loved him. And it was just about personality and that right fit. And it was nothing like they didn't do anything wrong. There was no criminality. There wasn't anything like that. It was just bad fit and personalities. Sure. And it's thinking about those things of you need to actually be able to think, do I really want to work for a giant engineering firm, or do I prefer like a small mom and pop sort of project? Do I like doing, you know, some project for 2 years, or do I prefer not knowing or changing it up every other week or something? So yeah, there's a lot that goes in that too.
Yeah, I did mention to the students that there, you know, there's a bad like identity given towards job hopping, or it's considered a bad term, but actually that's just the 21st century. And there is no such thing really as job hopping, because if you have an opportunity at another company and you think that'll fulfill the kind of lifestyle that you want to live, you're kind of crazy not to take that chance. If you, like you were saying, if you're working at a big company and one of the main things that you hate about that place is that it's so big, and then you have an opportunity that you feel will make you, you know, enjoy your job more or be more productive or whatever at a smaller company, then you're crazy not to leave your other one and stay unhappy, you know, to go to another one. And just like you were, mentioning about as your career progresses these days, pretty much the only way of progressing is to go from job to job, because it's, you know, very difficult. There is no real, I keep telling people that it's not really a jobs ladder, that it's more like a stream that has many different, you know, a braided stream with many different channels and side channels and all this other stuff. And it's all flowing towards, you know, the destination, hopefully, of the life that you want to live. But that there is no just marching straight up a ladder anymore. I mean, all the signs around us show that it's almost impossible to just work your way straight from the very bottom all the way to the top, because companies don't really function the way they did 50 years ago.
No, they don't. And actually, that was one of the days we spent on a course, was actually talking about job hunting and switching between and getting into the psychology of what an employer sees when they look at your CV and they see that you've had like 20 jobs. Now, in archaeology or CRM, that doesn't mean much, because usually by a couple of years in, everyone just has this generic thing saying, field tech, I worked for, and just list a bunch of companies and years, and no one really breaks it down to individual companies anymore, because it goes on, you know, you'd have a resume that's like 20 pages long, and that's fine, and that's acceptable. But in other sorts, other jobs in archaeology, that would raise a red flag. So if you're constantly moving around, and it's not for, say, field teching or CRM, and maybe you're a senior person who every 6 months changes and goes and be a new PI at a different company, that's going to probably raise some red flags for employers. And that's a lot about what the course was about, is thinking about how do you present yourself and how do you think others will interpret what your career has been?
Yeah. That's a lot of it, for sure. So let's give some of our favorite, I'm curious to what you got, some of your guys' favorite resources are that you point people to. Bill, you've linked to a few of them right now. I want to link to a bunch of stuff in this episode. And, so, you know, when people search jobs and they have that tag or something, and maybe they find it on the APN, at least they can point them to a few things. So, Bill White, we'll start with you. Do you have any other thing you want to point to, even some of your own resources we can put in the show notes, or things that you like that people can go to?
So locations where you can find jobs in archaeology, I think everybody agrees, Shovel Bums and Archaeology Fieldwork, those are the main two. But I would also put out there for other folks who are interested in historic preservation, PreserveNet, because PreserveNet has a lot of historic preservation planning jobs, a lot of architectural historian jobs. And then, you know, there are some kind of archaeology jobs working at living museums and stuff. But a lot of them aren't really the kind of in the dirt excavation or in the lab with bones and artifacts type jobs. But those still, if you know what you're doing when it comes to cultural resources, then you know that those are jobs that you can definitely get. And a few years ago, I wrote a PDF on using the internet to create your own online persona. And it's, you know, I don't know how much that will set you apart as far as field tech or whatever, but I definitely know that almost every, you know, professor or researcher or whatever, they're all building their own websites, but they don't always actually turn into the kind of thing that anyone would ever find. I think it was about using social media. I can't remember the title of it, but we can click to it or put a link to it. It's on the SHA blog. And there was a long ebook that I probably need to redo now with new technology and new social media apps. But, you know, it really was talking about the strategies that these other people who are these magical influencers use, except for in the case of us, we actually do have skills and education and, you know, we're not full of crap. But, you know, it's just using the internet to make your profile more visible.
Okay. What about you, Doug? Anything we haven't mentioned already that you want to get in the show notes for people to, you know, this can be either places to find jobs or places to learn about how to, you know, do stuff to get a job, like make a CV, things like that. So do you got any resources?
Yeah. I mean, your book is a good one.
Yeah.
I think if people actually just, I'm pretty sure you, me, and Bill are pretty much the only ones who have blogged about getting careers and CVs and stuff like that. I put ours down there.
Yeah.
Those are good resources. I'm pretty sure we're going to put a link to Joe and Carol's book. It's quite good. It was Left Coast Press, which has now been bought out by...
It was Rutledge, Taylor and Francis.
Yeah, so... it should still be in print, I'm pretty sure. And those are all good resources. Do you actually mind if I just ask Bill a quick question? Bill, have you, when you're talking to your students, have you found out what's their careers they're interested in?
Yeah, I have. And many of them are interested in bioanthropology. They really want to do bioanth. I don't know where this is all coming from, but...
Those are big.
Well, also, you know, the people there at Cal are excellent, right? So if you go to Cal, you're with some of the top people. But bioanth is definitely one. And I've talked to a lot of folks, especially after they find out about CRM, that want to go into historic preservation. So policy or work with the National Park Service or work with the National Trust or something. They really realize that actually they don't have to dig. They can do historic preservation. So I've seen that. And then a lot of, because I'm an archaeology professor, a lot of folks who want to do archaeology.
What's their, are these undergrads, masters? What sort of?
So they're, the undergrads are the ones that I have the most traction with. The PhDs, I think, are all just on the tenured, like, you know, blinders, but then it's even focused down to just the laser focus of tenure track, you know. So, and those folks, that's a whole different ball game of what they have to do to get a tenure track job. But the undergrads are still, you know, open to new ideas and they realize a lot of things. And so it's mainly undergrads.
And have you found that a lot of them want to do sort of, I guess, public engagement, public archaeology sort of stuff?
Yeah. No, yes. When it comes to archaeology, they're most interested in that kind of public engaged archaeology.
Yeah, that's a trend over here as well. That's picked up in the last couple of years. It used to be, you know, a lot of people wanted to go into being like professors and stuff like that. And I'm not sure when that changed. Like, I'm pretty sure that was like when you guys went through. What was your fellow cohort? Were they either not going to do archaeology, or were most of them thinking about doing like tenured or something like that?
At Arizona.
Yeah, or just anywhere. You, Chris, both Bills. Mm-hmm. What was like when you guys were going through? What were the main jobs that people were looking for, if they were looking for jobs in archaeology?
Well, mine's super easy because it was a CRM program, so it was archaeological resource management master's degree. So all the people in my cohort, I think there were five of us, they all came from CRM and they were going right back to CRM when they finished. And as far as I know, the only one I haven't been able to keep track of is one of them. And he was pretty young. He went undergrad right into master's. I think he had a little bit of experience. So I'm not actually sure what he ended up doing, but the others went back into CRM. So, yeah.
Yeah. For me, a lot of the undergrads cohorts disproportionately were interested in going to law school, getting their LSATs and going to law school. And I don't know if that's because of how close I was to Washington, D.C. A lot of the anthros were interested in going to law school afterwards. Mm-hmm. Now, there's very few, if any, that went into CRM.
When I was an undergrad at Boise State, no one knew what they were doing. And there was only one archaeologist, I think, that probably actually was pushing anything. I mean, I think I've written about this, like the highest percentage of classes that I never used ever since then came mm-hmm. from my undergrad. So Boise State was just getting a degree so I could go get a master's. But then by the time I went to the master's, I think most people at Idaho, we're going to go into either work for the Forest Service or the National Parks, because that's a big thing in the West, or go and do CRM. So most people were aimed towards that. And then at Arizona for my PhD, a lot of people, because it's Arizona, saw the value of doing CRM and that they could still do major research through CRM. So I think a lot of folks were either still working CRM while they were doing their PhD or were headed back to CRM, and then, you know, with the idea in the back of their head that if they were lucky, they would go into academia.
Yeah. If we're talking about undergrads too, I'm pretty sure none of the people in my undergrad class went into CRM, let alone stayed in anthropology. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah, it is interesting though. I think I've noticed in the last couple of years, a lot of undergrads or even grads, if you're thinking about a job in archaeology that's not CRM, mm-hmm. a lot of it's now like sort of public engagement stuff. Yeah. I'm not actually sure we even teach that too well either, how to get a job in that or how to even do that job.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I hope this has been informative for our listeners. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact us. Doug mentioned that Bill White and I and Doug have all written about jobs and employment and things like that. Our blogs are always linked on these podcast page. So arcpodnet.com/CRM arc podcast. And you can use the search bar on the right side there to search all 160 episodes as you're listening to this one, more if you're listening to this in the future. And that will search the tags, that will search the text, the titles, things like that. Won't search inside the podcast. So hopefully we wrote decent show notes, but check that out and feel free to reach out to us. All of us with Twitter feeds, those are also linked on the podcast show notes webpage. And I hope that, like I said, you found some good value in this. Please comment. Let us know what other things you guys would like to hear about related to this. We typically only talk about jobs maybe once a year, and this is about the time that we do it because, you know, this is when people are mostly looking for jobs. But if somebody gets out and they want some more information and they want us to bring somebody else on or talk about something else or really focus down on something specifically related to it, like maybe we can have a whole podcast on interviews. Who knows? So let's get those comments in and suggestions in, and we'll go from there. All right. Well, thank you for listening to the show, everybody. And again, send in your comments and thanks for listening. We'll be back next time. Check me out at the SAAs and all the other guys there. I'll be at the WildNote booth, so I'm really easy to find in the exhibit hall if you're going. So stop by and say hi. Back next time. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM arc podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks, everyone, for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we will see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
I don't even know what's happening. I don't even understand it. I'm just going to record silence.
So can you put this bit on your CV? Does this count?
your virtual CV?
This is service here.
That means a running...
There it is.
Oh, my
my God.
Hours of service. There you go.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.